Let me start with a story. When I was a PhD student at Northwestern University, I had an interdisciplinary PhD, but my dissertation was in sociology. And my mentor, one of my mentors, was a leading sociologist of religion. He led a consortium every few months for professors and PhD students across the Midwest. And he asked me to come. He said, I think you'd really enjoy it, in this particular meeting. And so, I came to the meeting. And there were about 30 professors and PhD students in the room. And we were all there to hear an up-and-coming sociologist read his paper about an evangelical church that he'd been studying. Now, at the time, 30-some years ago, evangelicalism was almost not discussed at all in the academic papers. First kind of established works were in the 80s, and I was getting my PhD in the 80s. Now, this sociologist's paper was forgettable. It wasn't that good, but his attitude was very memorable. He knew his crowd. He knew the crowd of the sociologists, and he was witty, he was sarcastic in how he portrayed evangelicals, and his mockery elicited peals of laughter from the audience, from this group. They're all laughing with him about this evangelical church that he was attending. And then once he finished his paper, the chairman, my friend, mentor, asked if any of us had any questions. I think I was the first one to raise their hand, and he called on me, and I said, I is one. And then I just paused for a second, and I said, the wonderful thing about being, you always sound better in your memory probably than you were at the time, but I'll kind of try to quote myself. I said, the wonderful thing about being a sociologist is we don't study bugs. Bugs never talk back. With sociology, we get to study people, and people get to talk back. And this is a perfect case in point. I'm one of the bugs, because not only am I an evangelical, studying evangelical church, I actually attend the very church you've just talked about. And I'd like to give you some perspective on it. And at that point, I'm not going to go into the details. I corrected some of his empirical misunderstanding. He'd been there 6 times. He didn't know what he's talking about on a few things. He just got it wrong. He just didn't do his homework well. So I corrected it. But then I did some more substantial things. I said, but those are empirical things that could be corrected if you would have stayed around a little longer. But the biggest problem is deeper. He said, in my understanding of practicing sociology, you have to have empathy. You have to be able to connect with and understand on the inside the worldview, and using the concrete categories of those people to really understand them. Otherwise, you're really not doing good sociology. You're not really understanding them. You're just critiquing them from the outside. And an illustration of that is, do you remember the laughter that came in the room? He said, now let's put a different subject to the laughter. Let's say the laughter was about black people. Or let's say the laughter was about Jews. Would that have been as funny? No, it wouldn't have been. Now, why is that? I think it tells us 2 things. It tells us, one, evangelicals are viewed within the academic world as on the outside. They can be disrespected safely. And then it also tells us something about ourselves, or leash. Those who laugh should tell you something about yourself. You have self-righteousness. You feel self-righteous about them because you feel better, or intellectually, or maybe even morally. Do you see that what's going on there in that dynamic? It's a barometer of your self-righteousness. Now, you could tell that's a pretty, I did it gracefully, fairly gracefully, I think. I wasn't angry or upset. I just kind of did it in that tone, the way I did it. And we had a really good discussion. It was really helpful and profitable. And the result was the chairman asked me to present the paper at the next gathering. He was very positive, So they were willing to learn and get feedback. But the reality is, my experience has been, I've studied philosophy, history, theology in the academic world. And that's the attitude that's often there in the academic world I'm in, is a mockery. A negative attitude, suspicion that evangelicals can be safely mocked. Okay, so when a PhD student is coming into this world to be trained, they have to realize they're coming into Mars Hill. Mars Hill. What was Paul's response to Paul? Some asked questions, some believed, some mocked him. Okay, the majority probably mocked him. Okay, we are stepping into modern Mars Hill when we go into academia. We have to realize it's not a neutral environment in most of our settings. And I'm going to describe to you what my experience has been, both in the US, but also as I've traveled around the world. I've taught in Asia, I've taught in Europe, and I'm going to give you experience, kind of my experience. I'm going to start with a pretty long quote. You got to be patient with me while I'm using it. Alvin Plantinga has probably been the most influential philosopher of religion from a Christian point of view in the last 50 years. When he started, there were three PhDs in universities in America who were Orthodox Christians. By the time he retired, it was estimated it was 10 to 15% of the philosophy departments in the United States were theists of some variety. So he had a profound influence on the discipline. And this is part of his inaugural address as the, in his chair when he became a chair at Notre Dame. But this is what he said. He said, consider a Christian college student from Grand Rapids, Michigan, say, who decides philosophy is the subject for her. Naturally enough, she will go to graduate school to learn how to become a philosopher. Perhaps she goes to Princeton or Berkeley or Pittsburgh or Arizona. Doesn't much matter which. There she learns how philosophy is presently practiced. This is the end of the quote here, but this is really important. It is natural for her, after she gets her PhD, to continue to think about and work on these topics. And it is natural, furthermore, for her to work on them in a way she was taught to, thinking about them in light of the assumptions made by her mentors in terms of the currently accepted ideas as to what a philosopher should start from or take for granted, what requires argument or defense, what a satisfying philosophical explanation or proper resolution to a philosophical question is like. This is a key part, that last paragraph, just stick with me here. She will be uneasy from departing widely from these topics or assumptions, feeling instinctively that any such departures are at best marginally respectable. Philosophy is a social enterprise, and our standards and assumptions, the parameters within which we practice our craft, are set by our mentors and by the great contemporary centers of philosophy. This idea is a social enterprise. Academia is a social enterprise. What Plantinga described philosophy, it's just as true in any other academic arena. I don't care what the topic is. You name the topic, it's a social enterprise. We learn, we're mentored, we're trained, we think, we write, we do research in social communities with our peers and most influentially with our mentors. The intellectual, social, and morals, intellectual, social, and moral norms of our community shape us in profound ways, often ways that we don't understand. So today I'm going to do a kind of a thought experiment. I'm going to kind of play out for you how that happens. How does the social enterprise of academia actually influence us and shape us? I'm going to use sociology as my lens to do that. You can look at different aspects of reality with different lenses. Each, in my view, you can look at history lens. It gives you like a magnification of by 10. Or you could do, looking at sociology, magnification by 50. It doesn't. But the point is, you're looking at different things, and different things come into focus when you use different academic categories. In my understanding, sociology is useful to look at these kinds of things that are social enterprises, how society impacts individuals. Sociology is particularly helpful for this. How does the social enterprise of academia actually influence us and affect us? Now, a couple comments on this. When people think about, sociology, two of the categories is functional analysis of it. What is the intended consequence of a PhD program? That's pretty easy to realize. It's so that somebody gets a PhD, they become a member of the academic club, they can get a job, they can teach, they can research, they can do their work. In other words, that's the goal of what's called a manifest function in the categories of sociology, the intended outcome. But there are unintended consequences to getting a PhD, and that's what we're going to be looking at. If you look at the idea of a tide, you think of a, if you've gone to the beach, you can see a tide. There's high tide when the water comes up to a certain point, and there's low tide. So, but there's something else that goes underneath the water. It's called a riptide. Okay? All of a sudden, it's not measuring what you can see. You can't see how a riptide works typically. Typically it's hidden in the water. So you can swim out, and all of a sudden, this riptide takes you out to sea. Many people have been drowned, swimming along as good swimmers, and they try to fight the riptide, and they don't make it because they don't understand what's going on. It's this thing that's coming underneath them and coming under the water and pulling out. And that's what I think we're seeing in some aspects of academia, is we're seeing that there is a riptide that's occurring, and there's unintended there's consequences to people who are coming in with a conscious, chosen commitment to Christianity. Now, from a sociological point of view, the term that's referred to a guy that I'm going to call Edward Evangelical, a young PhD student that goes from undergraduate to get their PhD. This Edward Evangelical going off to get their PhD. When sociology, the term for that explains that a child is learning a language, they're acquiring morality, you know, what's virtues and vices, they learn how to relate to others, how to build relationships, they're given a sense of identity. All that happens within socialization. But what I'd like to suggest to you is that a PhD program can be what's called a secondary socialization. Can almost have the same impact as a primary socialization. You learn a morality. You learn a language. You learn a way of relating to people. It, for some people, a PhD process shapes them so profoundly that you, as a Christian, you know what discipline they're in, but you don't know whose disciple they are anymore because they've been so transformed by the academic study. So from my point of view, I think we need to look at this and say, how does this happen? How can somebody be impacted, shaped, influenced by the academic study process? And I don't think it's just for PhDs. I think it happens all the time for undergraduates, people going off for undergraduate studies and their peers and their teachers, and there's the same kind of process. I'm focusing on PhD here, but the same thing's happening across the board. I think the greatest way that the spread of unbelief, and I'm just gonna say one comment on about it, it's the greatest opponent for the gospel. It's gone from less unbelief, meaning atheists, agnostics, and those who say none of the above, when a survey question says, what religion are you? They say none of the above. That group has gone from less than 1% of the world's population to 15% in 100 years. I mean, that has blown away any other growth. It's the fastest growing religion in the world is unbelief, okay? And so, you know, evangelicalism has been the fastest growing historic faith. It's grown by 122%, going from 4%, 4.5% to 11% in that same time period. So we think we're doing really well, but in fact, unbelief has blown past us. And what I'd like to suggest is the way that unbelief has grown is through education. This process of education has been the process by which unbelief has spread this pandemic. So we're living in the middle of a spiritual pandemic that's not been recognized for over 100 years. So how do we understand it? I'm going to have to use some language that's sociological language, but just put up with it. I'm going to talk about these phrases, and I'm going to unpack what they mean, so you don't have to worry about it. But why I'm using them is it gives us the lenses to understand Edward Evangelical's experience. Okay, so first one, pluralization and privatization. Just to remind you, what you already know, universities are institutions of learning and knowledge in our pluralistic societies. Almost any belief that's in the society is present in the university. Part of the consequence of so many different world and life views is that many people are exposed to things that they didn't believe, you know, before coming to college as an undergraduate. Now, just think of somebody growing up in the Sunni Muslim world of Saudi Arabia. There's only one public religion. There's only one accepted interpretation of it. Evangelism from a Buddhistic or Christian or any other religious point of view is outlawed. It's outlawed. You can't do it. You know, in this situation, there's little to no choice. There's very little choice. You're socialized into it, and there's not an option of choice. But what are the consequences of pluralism on someone like this Edward Evangelical guy, this figure and type I'm talking about here? You know, someone like Edward, he's been fairly cocooned within his Christian community. And let's say he went through his undergraduate, he's part of a Christian fellowship, IFES movement in his country, deeply involved in Bible study and prayer groups, people that are studying his topics. But all of a sudden, when he goes off for doing his PhD, there's nobody in his PhD program that is an evangelical Christian. In fact, there's also nobody in his church that's getting a PhD. You know, that's not always the case, but you get the point. It's rare. It's rare. We're not sending loads of people off. And so basically, he feels a little bit of an alien in his church, and a little bit of an alien in his academic department. And he's got beliefs that don't fit in. So all this comes down to is this, is that all this exposure to pluralism increases the questions that Edward has. All of a sudden, he's exposed to issues he doesn't have an answer to. It's normal. He's learning things. He doesn't know how it fits. How does it fit with my Christian worldview? The challenges, ways of framing knowledge, how to formulate things. Now, I won't quote Karl Marx very often, but he has a account where he echoes Aristotelian and Aristotle idea. He writes in Thesis to Feuerbach, he says, he who formulates the question answers it. So if you read Karl Marx, and if you accept the way he defines issues in the first 25 pages, you're a Marxist by page 25. Because you've accepted the way he framed the question, okay? And the same thing's true to some extent in all of our academic disciplines. If you accept the way things are framed just completely from whatever the academic discipline, you're accepting those things on a foundational level. And so the result of that is all of a sudden there's a new belief system that's emerging as Edward becomes experienced in his discipline, learns about his discipline, and those things begin challenging his worldview, his Christian worldview. He has questions that he didn't have before. And the second thing to just keep in mind is in a pluralistic society, people push your personal beliefs and say, that's your private belief. In other words, it doesn't have access to truth. It's not an issue of fact. It's a fact-moral distinction to say anybody's faith is, that's not something subject to knowledge and truth and discipline. It's what you, but keep it out of your work. Keep it out of your work. Don't, you know, keep your belief to yourself. We don't want to hear about it. Okay, all this, you know, if you apply it to the Edward Evangelical, and he shows up for his first day of his PhD program, and he's confronted by an establishment that's been running for decades. You know, everybody knows what a PhD student's role is. Everybody knows, you know, what's expected for a good PhD student, how a good PhD student succeeds and how they don't succeed. You know, most of the expectations for a PhD student are not in the manual. It's not in the description of the PhD program. They're embedded in the social understanding of Edward's mentors and eventually it's his peers. Everybody accepts that this is how you write a good paper. This is how you frame a good argument. Remember Plantinga's comment. So to understand a little bit more about Edward's dilemma, we've got to realize we've got to understand sociology of knowledge. Peter Berger defines it this way. He says that sociology of knowledge is what everyone knows about a social world, the assembly of maxims, morals, proverbial nuggets of wisdom, values, beliefs, myths, and so forth. In other words, there's what everybody knows in sociology or in history. Now, it's broad terms, but the point is in that discipline, there's accepted ways of doing the discipline, and that's what everybody knows. Academia, or our portion of academia, have a symbolic universe, and that's why there are tensions even between different branches of academia, between the humanities and the sciences, for example. But all of this leads to this point, is that in sociology of knowledge, it's the phrase plausibility structures. What are the social plausibility structures that make something look plausible? Okay, when Edward enters in this world, the categories of his discipline, they give insight. You know, it's like a snow with an Eskimo. They have 50 different names for snow. Why? Because they live in a world of snow. They have all these different variations of understanding different types of snow. Okay, so they have a knowledge and experience. And it's true, in an academic discipline, you get lenses that you can see things and brings things into focus that you didn't have before. And so there's plausibility that is linked to all of this, to the social world of your academic department, of academia in general, but it also gives you genuine insight, okay? But it's done in relationship. Now, most evangelicals come to a PhD experience as relatively young individuals, and they're still building life convictions. They're vulnerable to the incredibly powerful shaping influence of their mentors. Think of Edward Evangelical again. He is being shaped. He's that child entering into secondary socialization. Now, think about your children. You know, a typical 2-year-old, 3-year-old, there is rebellion that's there. But also, most children want to please their parents. They want to be loved and connected to, and they want to please them. There's instinctive things built into that relationship. And there's also built into the mentoring relationship for Edward. Okay, Edward wants to get the PhD, and he realized the only way he can is if he makes his mentor or mentors happy. So he's motivated to please them. He's motivated to adapt. He's motivated to adjust. Now, to some extent, we've got to realize part of this is part of the healthy academic process. You don't know everything when you enter a PhD program, and you should adjust, and there should be education, and there should be willingness to learn. But in the midst of this process, you sometimes get the questions framed in a way that he who formulates the question answers it. In other words, if you allow the discipline to formulate these questions of knowledge and how to approach things and what is considered knowledge, all of a sudden Christianity viewed from that perspective is distorted, okay? Okay, so coming to the next point right here is that there is a conformity that happens. It is a relational and conversational process. It's typically not a self-conscious process from the mentors, but sometimes it is. I remember I was fortunate enough to get, you know, what's called in the States straight A's in my first year of my PhD. And going to my second year, and then I realized this one guy was only giving good grades to people who adopted his process theology. You had to take his categories if you're going to get, you know, a really good grade. Well, if you didn't, you're not getting one of the top grades, okay? And his response, I said, come on, you know this paper's, I mean, he's a friend. He became a friend. We'd get together and talk, and he was a genuine friend. You know, this is good. You've just told me how good it is, but you've said it's a B+. It's not an A. Come on. He goes, you're not willing to learn. And I said, you mean I'm not willing to adopt your process theology? Well, he says, that's what I mean. You're not willing to learn. He was willing to admit it. If people did not transition to his categories for approaching theology, he would not give them a top grade. Now, that doesn't happen that often, but it does. And it's usually more subtle. It's not very people that are honest enough, like that guy was as a friend to me, to tell me, yeah, I want people to be willing to learn my categories and adapt them and use them in their papers. My point behind all this is there is this conformity that happens, and even social control. Now, there's an illustration that Plantinga used, and it's a useful category. And he's talking about the same PhD student who's a woman PhD, and she says she studies with Leonard Quinn. He was a professor at Harvard, probably for a time, he's dead now, one of the most influential philosophers in America and in the world. And this is what he says, Plantinga says about this theoretical PhD students. She finds herself attracted to Quinn's programs and procedures, his radical empiricism, his allegiance to natural science, his inclination toward behavioralism, his uncompromising naturalism, his taste for desert landscapes, you know, even his appreciation of certain art. It would be wholly natural for her to become totally involved in these projects and programs, to come to think of fruitful and worthwhile work as substantially circumscribed by them. In other words, the way you do philosophy is within those categories. And then Plantinga makes this comment. One philosopher I knew embarking on such a project suggested that Christians should think of God as a set, because Quinn was prepared to countenance the upset. So in other words, to such an extent, it shapes their understanding that God's a set. In other words, God's not a supernatural. And you see the impact. That's a graphic example of it. But this, you know, what Plantinga is saying is the powerful effect of these people who are 30 years older, vastly more educated, can shape these younger students in a profound way. Okay, now all this builds to the next point. This creates doubt. This process that Edward is going through, he is not conscious of what I've just described at this point. He's not aware of this process of being socialized into the categories and structures of his discipline. But he begins to be aware that there's questions he doesn't have answers to. There's doubt-producing questions. His training is forcing his theological beliefs into a privatized sphere. And a friend of mine was pastor of a church right next to Oxford University, and had 20 Oxford faculty in it. He said, I think all of them have privatized their faith, leading intellectual thinkers, but this process of socialization has pushed them to put their faith into this little box, and it doesn't impact their discipline. Okay? Do you see the process? If you're not conscious of it, if you're not choosing to address it and integrating it, you're going to have it pushed away if you keep your faith at all. Okay? All of this leads to the next thing. One more comment on this is that I think academics are better at studying their subject than they are at studying themselves. I don't think most academics are conscious of the way things are impacting them. I think they're very good analytically. They're gifted analytically, usually gifted writers, ability to frame things, to make arguments, but they don't understand how things are impacting them. And there's an old Chinese proverb. I'm still assuming that I'm going to find it in the Bible someday. But I haven't found it yet. It says, if you want to understand the water, you don't ask a fish. In other words, because you're seeing with the water, the fish is seeing through the water and experiencing it, it's really difficult to understand the water. And the same way, someone experiencing this, it's very difficult to become self-conscious. And a lot of seduction is not a conscious process. And this leads to this issue of why is this so powerful? It's a slow, not conscious process on the part of the seduced individuals. There's no blunt effort usually to get Edward to jettison their faith. It's just this socialization that happens. But why is it so powerful? Academia is a social institution and a structure that's been created and maintained over decades of experience. Remember what we talked about, social knowledge? Everyone knows how to do this discipline. Everyone knows how to make an argument, how that particular discipline is supposed to function. Everyone knows what a PhD student is supposed to do and how to do it. Now, we all want to fit in. If you're in a PhD program, you want the PhD. You want to join the club. You desire to do that. You use those skills and abilities that you have. It's not a purely psychological process, although that's part of it. It is this sociological process of pushing us toward this. Now, all of this is, we're almost done with these categories, but a couple more I'm going to give to you. Just to kind of unpack it a little bit more, is that my experience is many young evangelicals are swept off their feet by this process, by the questions and the agenda of their intellectual community, of whatever discipline they're in. They are a cognitive minority, and few people within their discipline or their world, academia in general, accept their convictions, their theological convictions. And most PhD students are unprepared for it. They're unprepared for this process. Now, this is something that I think you can give you different illustrations of it. One that Plantinga talks about is logical positivism. That was way back in his early part of his career that said, you know, anytime Christians made affirmations that were not directly connected to empirical data, they were nonsense. And for a time, Christians had no answer to this, They weren't able to respond or deal, and eventually it was discredited and shown that it was intellectually inconsistent itself, because even the assertion didn't have any empirical data in it, in the assertion. So this logical positivism fell apart in its own thing. But the problem is, you accept the question, you don't challenge the way things are framed, you're left with the question. You become the Marxist if you don't challenge Marx's categories, if you don't challenge Marx's definitions. Now, all of this leads to what in sociology is called nihilation. The sociological theory for destabilizing someone's worldview is nihilation. It comes from the word nihilism, the philosophical belief that rejects the existence of meaning. By destabilizing someone's worldview, you push them toward this nihilism. Now, Peter Berger, who's a sociologist, says, quote, when you lose meaning, you have what's kind of anomy, the idea of nomos, the idea of law, and you have no law. In other words, it's his words, a condition of rootlessness, disorientation, no longer feeling at home with the world. So Edward Evangelical is beginning to not just have a privatized belief, not just have a belief that's challenged, not to have just doubts, but he's pushed toward giving up his faith. Do you see the natural process of giving up the faith? Now, it's not automatic, but it happens. Now, all this comes to the idea of questioning truth itself. In my department of sociology, where I did my dissertation, there wasn't a single professor that that hadn't been divorced at once. Most of them had been divorced twice. One of them was divorced three or four times, and one of his wives killed him. It's just, why? Because they didn't believe in truth. They didn't believe that you have to persevere in a relationship. They didn't have some criteria of ethics that said, no, once you make a commitment, even though it's difficult, you persevere through it. It was a natural consequence of their moral beliefs that they accepted from sociology. If everything's relative, then there's no reason to persevere in a relationship or commitment. So all of this leads toward this pressure toward relativity and even towards cynicism. The instinctive response by somebody who's being trained in any academic enterprise, when they hear an argument, they'll say, yes, but. Yes, but. That's the instinctive response. Because why? Because they've been trained to think well, carefully about the discipline or topic. And they'll say, I don't like the way that that's framed. Yes, there's some things, but it's, yes, but. Part of it, it's the analytic gift that they've received and that they've been developing in their academic work. There's nothing wrong with that. But but embedded in that is a disbelief in any type of truth. There's no way you can articulate truth if you're constantly suspicious of any assertions. Berger, again, is useful. He says, the sociological perspective is not conducive to an onward and upward outlook, will rather lead to one degree or another of disenchantment with regard to the interpretations of social reality given in Sunday schools. In other words, it basically creates suspicion and cynicism. And it's not just Sunday schools. He's saying cynicism in general. Okay, and that pushes people toward agnosticism. And agnosticism has a myth of neutrality. A fellow we had speak at our first forum event was William Lane Craig. And Bill Craig is an apologist, very effective. And he'd go around and debate leading atheists. And he told me a number of years ago, because I'm finding it really hard to find good debating partners. And I said, well, explain that. You know, there's a lot more people who affirm unbelief than Christianity. Why is that? He goes, I'm finding so many more agnostics that are just, yeah, you believe that, I don't know, nobody knows, and it's the myth, it's a huge group of agnostics and fewer hard-boiled atheists that are willing to give assertions and argument and evidence. And so he's hard to find. And a funny thing happened in when he went to the UK a number of years ago, all of these atheists who said, I'll debate anybody anywhere, like Dawkins and all these guys said, I'll debate anybody anywhere. And he came and they all turned it down. And finally, one of the atheists said, we're all running scared. We're running scared from him. So I'm gonna debate him, but I'm just going to condemn my fellow atheists. You're a bunch of chickens. And so he debated, but the whole point is they it's hard to find them because they're not willing to stand up and actually debate him. Now, in this situation, the agnosticism is powerful, is that it gives a myth of neutrality. There's stepping away from the tough discussion of is there a God or is Christianity too, and into a lazy kind of skepticism. Now, but what happens with it is Edward feels like, he has questions he doesn't have answers to. He has questions he doesn't know. Nobody's there as a mentor for him. Nobody's there to answer his questions. No one's even identified this process I've talked about here. And so for him, he thinks he's the only one in the world that's wrestling with this. And for him, he feels like, if I'm going to be honest, I have unanswered questions. My parents taught me this faith, or I came to a, conversion, but I don't know how to answer. In other words, he's one question after another is removing kind of the brick wall of faith. And eventually, you remove enough bricks, what happens to the wall? The wall falls down, okay? And that's there's a plausibility to the academic world, not necessarily intellectual credibility, but plausibility because of the social reality of that world. So how do we respond to this? I'm going to be kind of bringing it to close, dealing. How do we respond to this process of sociological seduction? As long as someone's worldview for explaining life works reasonably well, they have fewer doubts about it. What happens when their worldview does not integrate with their learning, with their academic discipline? What happens when Edwards, confronted by this seemingly objectively true academic world I've just described, a cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is a term to describe a tension between some set of beliefs that you have. In this case, between Edwards' private religious beliefs that have been privatized and his professional academic world and its beliefs. The tension we hold between two different and very conflicting sets of belief systems. The word doubt has its root meaning of being in two minds. It isn't the word of unbelief, it's the two minds. In other words, it's between belief and unbelief. It's another way of describing this cognitive dissonance. It's not a good place to be, but it doesn't mean it's bad. Lebris has the principle, an honest question deserves an honest answer. An honest question, But this process of answering people's questions, that's partly what Jesus did. But he didn't have any patience for people that were asking questions dishonestly. You know, you look at the arguments he has with people in John, and eventually it says they went away from him. They never asked him another question. Why? Because he destroyed them in these debates. It's debates that's going on there in John. It's an intellectual debate that's happening. Okay, all of this leads to four possible solutions. Somebody can be cognitively converted, conversion to the academic universe's symbolic, universe called agnosticism. Now, in sociological terms, Edwards' convictions of evangelicalism, of faith, it's a cognitive minority, and that we will have an uncomfortable relationship sometimes with the broader majority world. Many believers have been swept off their feet, and I've seen them again and again go through this process, and no one has recognized that there's a need to mentor PhD students, not no one, but a commitment to do that is essential as part of their PhD studies. Not just on a spiritual level in terms of your devotional life and your walk with the Lord, but helping you to process and answer your questions. This is really crucial. So many people have been swept off their feet, so we haven't had a commitment to apologetics, to answering people's questions. We haven't understood the importance of the academic role, the importance of individuals being trained in this way, and we haven't understand the importance of investing in them. As I already mentioned, there's intellectual insights from the discipline, there's status and respect that come, and so this individual that gets converted slides toward a kind of an agnosticism, and then there's a break. And a good example is Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman, you know, he says, honestly, because there's nothing in my academic studies of the Bible that caused me to become an atheist. Intellectually, because what happened? He said, I was confronted with the problem of pain. I didn't have an answer for it. Nobody wrestled with him with the problem of pain, answering his question, the problem of pain. And so once he converts to atheism, didn't come from his background as a Greek scholar or New Testament scholar, but once he converts, now it's everything reinterpreted from that atheistic position. Do you see what, if a good debater, which they, we shouldn't be talking right here, Bart, about, the New Testament. You've admitted there was nothing in your New Testament studies that led you toward atheism. But let's put that aside. The problem is you don't understand the problem of pain. This problem has been philosophically addressed, and most people don't believe it. You have an outdated 35-year-old understanding of the problem of pain. This is the way it's been framed, and this is not a killer for anybody in this position. In fact, people, atheists, acknowledge it. You just don't know what you're talking about. You need to reframe the discussion. Do you see what I'm saying there? But the process he went through, it was a conversion, and then he reinterprets his discipline from that new position. Now, all this leads toward the second option, is that sometimes people don't convert. Someday they don't make the conversion to agnosticism or atheism, but there's a cognitive surrender. And this one's even more subtle. It's even more subtle. I grew up in a United Methodist church, never heard the gospel. It was a liberal church. I left any form of Christianity, became an agnostic, converted, convinced agnostic. I said, anybody who said they know the name of God is a fool. And I only came to faith later when I was convinced that the gospel was really true, that people could answer my questions. And I wrestled for a year on this issue. Well, what happens with liberal Christianity, and I've experienced growing up, and I experienced then later when I taught at a liberal seminary, is they don't accept as fundamental the convictions of Scripture. They accept as fact the majority is right and then adapt themselves to that point of view. So liberals are accepting these these categories from their discipline or from the culture. And it was a cognitive adjustment, that's an important word, to of Christianity to the alleged or actual worldview of modernity. And a progressive, as Berger says, dismantling of the supernatural scaffolding of Christian religion. And it's a perfect illustration of this of the liberal Bultmann in the 20th century said, the belief in miracles in the New Testament has no place in a world that uses electric lights. So liberal option surrenders the worldview content, adapts itself to the unbelieving worldview, but still uses Christian language. So for example, that professor I referred to, he was a process theologian. He wrote a Christology. And again, I was wrestling with this. I said, why in the world are you going to write a Christology? You don't believe in the Trinity. You don't believe in Christ. You don't believe in the resurrection. You know, you got to explain this to me. And he said, just because I don't believe what historic Christians believe doesn't mean I can't use the categories. Okay? For him, the word Christ, you could take a glass and dump it out of wine and fill it with water or Coke. Okay, the word is just a glass that can be dumped of content. That's what liberals do. They're using the same categories. So for many people who are not aware, it's more difficult to get your arms around. They're using categories, but they don't believe what Christians have believed. T.S. Eliot said this. He said, liberal Christians are those who consider superfluous essential elements of historic Christianity and discard them. And then everything is still framed in Christian categories, but they have different content. Okay. Now, the way it works is, and this is again Berger, someone proceeds to relativize religious tradition by assigning it in part or in whole to a consciousness that's now passé, that's no longer possible to us, and to translate it partially or whole into terms that are supposedly consonant with the alleged modern consciousness. So I'd like to give you an illustration of this. I mean, there's a reason that all the liberal churches are collapsing. There's a reason that you look in the UK, for example, and the liberal churches, they're almost non-existent, you know, after 100 years of this. They're not self-perpetuating. There's not any spread of, there's no gospel. There's no outreach. The only people that are converted are foolish evangelicals who accept the categories that the liberals are starting with. I mean, that's the problem, is we're naive. We don't understand that there's theological apologetics we need to be engaged with. What's the Reformation? It's theological apologetics. It's Luther affirming, no, we're not saved through sacraments and of grace that's excreted through object category, physical objects. We're saved through faith alone, like Paul said, okay? It's a Reformation with theological apologetics, clarifying truth in response to error. And that's what we need to do. We have to stop being naive about liberal thinking. It's alien scripture, it's not Christian, and it's killing the church when people accept it. It's just killing the church. Okay, next category is cognitive retreat, separating faith from reason. I've already talked about this, is that people are pressured to put their faith in a little separate category versus their discipline. So they operate in two separate non-conflicting spheres. And I've already told you about my friend at Oxford, who used to be a pastor there. And, you know, all these brilliant Oxford faculty, but they didn't think Christianly about their discipline. They're just thinking as sociologists, and they're thinking as faithful Christians taking care of their family. But they don't bring the two together. The last category that's connected to this is the idea of fideism. Faith being separated from reason. This is the idea that we shouldn't be willing to affirm that Christianity is true. We need to trust God. We need to trust God, and there should be no presentation of an argument. I think it's a good-hearted statement, but it's not biblical. What did Paul say? The things I say are true, and they're reasonable. And then Felix's response to him, say, you're trying to persuade me. Are you trying to persuade me? And he says, yes, wish everybody was like I am, except for these chains. Absolutely, I'm trying to persuade you. Paul calls the gospel the word of truth. Paul enters into the synagogue, it says, as his custom was. He did it all the time. He showed them from the scriptures why Jesus was the Christ, arguing, proving, demonstrating. this process of engaging and showing why the gospel is true. Then in the same chapter Acts 17, he interacts with the pagans and he refers to the unknown God. He refers to two different poets. He doesn't do what he did with the Jews. He communicates differently why the gospel is true. Let me explain to you. You're deeply religious because you're the unknown God. He's communicating persuasively the gospel is true. We need to recognize that we need to be confident and stand on the truthfulness of God's word and the truthfulness of the gospel. And this is the last category, the cognitive independence, being willing to engage the issues, answering tough questions, not accepting cognitive conversion to agnosticism, not accepting cognitive surrender to liberal Christianity or cognitive retreat into a privatized faith or fideistic faith. We have to be honest about the problem. We have to realize that this description I've given you is true, not in the same exact way, but in different ways with different disciplines and different contexts. But this is coming your way, no matter where you are in the world. And it's already here in Europe. It's already there in the U.S. And it's coming your way. We need to be honest about the apologetic questions. We need to be willing to address people's honest questions. C.S. Lewis once wrote, he said, a Christian scholar should face up to those elements of original Christianity in which he personally finds obscure. You know, 2 days ago, I talked to Pete about the passage he preached this morning. You know, he says, I'm still wrestling with what it means. You know, he's still wrestling with what it means. With this process doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. It's a wonderful search for truth our whole life. We know that it means these things, but there's more to it. You know, for me, this process of understanding truth and being rooted, being confident in the truthfulness is something we can rejoice in. This is what the gospel is all about. And we got to disbelieve intellectual fads. Basil Mitchell, who's an Oxford philosopher, said, quote, there occurs the special sort of silliness and subservience to fashion in which intellectuals are peculiarly susceptible. Fashion. You know, there's waves of fashion. Postmodernism, the fashion of emergent theology, goes away. And process theology, you can't find a process theologian out there. You can't find a hardcore liberal, it doesn't matter. The point is, they're fashions. They float away after a few years. We need to have more confidence and independence and conviction. And I'm going to go back to Plantinga here now for a long quote. Stick with me. This is what he says. Christian philosophers should have adopted, you're talking about that issue with positivism. He says, should have adopted a different attitude toward positivism. What they should have said to the positivists is this. Your criteria is mistaken, for such statements as God loves us and God created the heavens and the earth are clearly meaningful. So if they aren't verifiable in your sense, then your sense is false, that only all and only statements are verifiable in that sense are meaningful. That was, you don't accept the question. You don't accept the question. You don't accept the assertion. Then he says this. He says, what was needed was here was less accommodation to current fashion and more Christian self-confidence. Christian theism is true. And if Christian theism is true, then the verifiable criteria of positivism is false. You know, and so he ends with this comment, and I think I'm going to end with it too. He says, the Christian philosophers should have displayed more integrity, more independence, less readiness to trim their sails to the prevailing philosophical winds of doctrine, and more Christian self-confidence. It's true in philosophy. It's also true in every other intellectual discipline.